2, 1.
Good morning from KSK Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board investigation at the grounding of the Exxon Valdez. I'm Corey Flintoff. I'm here with Bruce Melzer, and we're waiting for the Board of Inquiry to assemble on the podium here at the Captain Cook Hotel. They're just getting together now. This hearing today is actually starting early because yesterday's testimony went so long, and the Board of Inquiry is faced with a marathon. There are 28 witnesses altogether. Only 6 were heard yesterday.
On the list today, we're going to start off with James R. Conkle, who is the chief mate of the Exxon Valdez. He is one of two officers who was licensed to pilot the ship. Well, actually, I'm not sure about that. But Conkle was one of the chief mates, and he was below. He was asleep when the Exxon Valdez ran aground. He was not on the bridge at the time, and so one of the things that they're going to be talking about is talking to him, find out what he knew about the grounding. In addition, the other line of questioning for him will be how exhausted he was and why his responsibilities were such that he was not available when it was time for the Exxon Valdez to leave its port.
Actually, he's been a kind of a mystery man throughout. We've heard a great deal about the whereabouts and the activities of Captain Joseph Hazelwood and of Third Officer Gregory Cousins, but very little about the chief mate and his second officer, very little about where they were, what their role in this was. And of course, as in any maritime accident, everyone's ticket is on the line, as they say. Everyone's reputation, everyone's career is on the line, and especially the senior officers below the captain. So it'll be interesting to see what his perspective on all this is. Another important line of testimony that'll be taken up later this morning, assuming that the inquiry with Kunkel goes fairly quickly, will be with the Marine Safety Office of the U.S. Coast Guard. And the executive officer of that office, Lieutenant Commander Thomas Falkenstein, will be on the stand. And a great deal of that testimony, we assume, will have to do with the Coast Guard's tanker traffic control system.
Also on the list today is going to be Gregory P. Taylor, who was on the 1600 to 2400 shift, the shift that went right up until the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, until about 4 minutes before the grounding of the Exxon Valdez. And this is the man who was tracking the Exxon Valdez on the radar. It seems that we're going to hear a lot of questions about why Coast Guard radar was unable to pick up the fact that this ship was straying dangerously close to reefs. What type of controls and feedbacks exist for the captains, for the people who are guiding these tankers, from the independent eyes, the people who are on the shore and have the radar equipment and the facilities there to monitor what's going on. Those radar systems have been cut back over the years. They have not been beefed up when they've had the opportunity to be beefed up. And so some of the questions will undoubtedly be directed in that direction as the investigation gets underway.
He'll be followed by the man who held the midnight to 8 o'clock watch, Bruce Blandford, also a vessel traffic controller for the Coast Guard. And also on the witness list for today, although the way things went to yesterday, it may be a rather slow process, is Mike Pete, a toxicologist. So we can anticipate that there'll be more talk about the blood test that said that Captain Hazelwood was beyond the limit for blood alcohol content to be piloting a tanker, or I think indeed any other commercial vessel in the United States.
We heard a number of questions yesterday about Exxon's alcohol policy, about a policy which is that someone who uses alcohol, is caught with alcohol on vessels, does get fired. We heard questions about how that policy was enforced, and some people said that they never actually seen it enforced or known of it being enforced, but some of those questions will come into play today as we start talking with the toxicologist and looking at the kinds of impact that alcohol has on ship operating personnel.
We did get a good sense yesterday afternoon, I think, of a little bit of what ship's routine is like. We heard from some of the able-bodied seamen who were on the watch that night, and a little bit about what sounds to me like a rather isolated, lengthy, remote kind of work duty, where people seem to be very much involved with themselves and not much a community of workers on board this vessel.
Clearly they're sealed off in their own world, as one of the fellows described it, what he does when Russell Kagan, you know, when he does when he's off, is he goes and he sits in his easy chair. And that in some respects kind of summed up the kind of portrait that it paints of the folks who man and woman these vessels. That it is, they do their watches, they have very specific duties, and when they're off, they go right to sleep, because in a couple hours, they're going to be back on again. And it is just, I mean, we heard a description yesterday of the Exxon Valdez running aground on the rocks and people going back to their rooms and pretty much, you know, sitting there, eventually going back to sleep. Not this huge congregation someplace where they're all sitting there talking about what's happening, at least from their descriptions. It wasn't like there's this hubbub of activity. It wasn't the sense that there was a crisis going on. There was a sense that they were kind of isolated, and they sort of went off and did what they did and, you know, went to sleep because they, you know, knew they'd have to come back to work again.
That's stunning to me, because we're told, or at least the impression one got at the time, was that had the tanker come off the reef, it could have easily have capsized and taken everybody on board with it. In addition, there was talk at some of the news conferences. In fact, one of the reasons why they didn't want to boom the vessel off, supposedly, because there was so much flammable gas that was being released from the crude oil in the water. So it seems that these people were remarkably, incredibly calm and distanced from the event in what was really a very dangerous situation.
And at least it appeared, as far as we could tell from the testimony yesterday, that they weren't even aware of some of the dangers that were facing them, or if they were, that, or certainly that their management did not make them aware of some of the dangers that some of them may have put two and two together. But at least yesterday, the way the testimony came out from the people on board the ship, they pretty much went about their business relatively unconcerned to what was going on.
The testimony yesterday established, as well as could be, at least to this point, a timeline of what happened immediately before and after the accident. In fact, the question, questioning repeatedly from William Woody, who's the chief investigator here, was an attempt to develop a chronology of exactly what happened when during that very short time, just before and after midnight, when the vessel ran aground. Today it looks as if we're going to hear a lot more about the response after, you know, we'll hear about the hours afterward.
I think we're also going to hear some more building that timeline, but kicking it off with the first two people who are actually, the Falkenstein and Taylor, people who were manning the vessel traffic control service. We will hear some of that building a timeline, but I think we'll start moving beyond that. We've just gotten word from the podium that they're waiting for their first witness, the chief mate of the Exxon Valdez. This kind of happened yesterday when they called a witness, and it appeared for a moment that the witness wasn't going to show.
Mr. Kunkel, you will be our first witness this morning. Mr. James Kunkel, chief mate on the Exxon Valdez. Mr. Colucciello, will you swear in and qualify the witness, please?
Please raise your right hand. Do you swear that the testimony you are about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Please be seated. Please state your full name.
James R. Kunkel.
And who is your employer?
Exxon Shipping Company.
What is your position within the company?
I'm currently on the chief mate list.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been with the Exxon?
Almost 10 years. September will be 10 years.
Do you hold any licenses?
Yes, I do.
And what grade is that?
I hold a Master Unlimited license.
All right, Mr. Kunkel. Mr. Johnson will now continue the interview.
Good morning, Mr. Kunkel. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Could I get a drink of water, please?
Certainly.
Okay.
Mr. Kunkel, you mentioned that you were on the chief mates list with Exxon. Are you permanent chief mate aboard the Exxon Valdez?
Yes, I was told that this would be my permanent ship.
How many previous tours have you had aboard the Exxon Valdez?
I had one tour in the fall of 88.
Have you sailed with Captain Hazelwood before?
He was the master for most of that time period, I believe.
Would you take a few moments and describe briefly the cargo system aboard the Exxon Valdez?
What would you like to know about it?
The cargo capacity, the basic cargo configuration.
Full load on the vessel is about 1.5 million barrels. Their draft would be about 64 feet at that time. She has five center tanks, and then she has eight wing tanks that are available for cargo. She also has four wing tanks that are available for ballast. Her forepeak is also a ballast tank. By ballast, I mean segregated ballast. That's the basic system on the ship. I have more information on it if you want it.
That's okay. Would you please describe the activities that occurred on the 23rd of March between 1800 and the time that you retired to your cabin just before midnight?
Let's see, 1800 on the 23rd. At that time, I was on watch. By the way, based on what I'm telling you now, it's my perception that in the testimony that you all provided to me, the work schedule is improper. On that day, we stood the normal four on and eight off, not six and six, as it shows here. So I was on watch at that time at 1800. And about 1800, Mr. Cousins, the third mate, came in, and I had him assist me in the topping off operation. It must have been 1830 or so. We topped a couple tanks off. I was satisfied with the way the vessel was looking, and I left Mr. Cousins in the control room, and I went on the dock to observe the drafts and ensure that the vessel was going to meet the drafts that I had required, and Mr. Cousins was in the control room. When the vessel arrived at the drafts that I wanted, I instructed him to shut the cargo down, which he did, and it's my recollection that that was about 1924.
And what happened next?
I asked Mr. Cousins if all the valves and everything were closed. He informed me that they were. I told him, okay, go up and test the gear, and that I would check the deck, which is what I did. In other words, I came back aboard. I made sure that the chick sands were being disconnected, that the valves were actually closed at the chick sand connection, the manifold area. I also went down in the pump room to make sure that no surprises had happened during the loading operation, because the pumps, of course, were shut off. You don't use pumps to load. I checked that the C-suctions and everything were tight. And eventually, I did get back into the cargo control room, and I confirmed that we were what we call condition green. In other words, all valves closed, safe. The gauger, of course, was doing his job, and he was asking me questions like, what are the drafts, and he was figuring up his numbers. And I recall signing his paperwork, and this would have to be somewhere in the 20 to 2030 area.
What time was the sailing board set for?
The sailing board was set for 2100. It is my understanding that sometime on the 12 to 4 watch in the afternoon, that the board was moved to approximately 2,200, but only for a very short period of time. What had happened was is that normally we would load the ship at 100,000 barrels an hour. The terminal had reduced our rate to about 83,000. My instructions to the second mate were to take a look at it, and if the rate continued, because the terminal kept saying, we'll give you more, we'll speed it up, but we're not sure. In other words, they couldn't pin them down. And I told them, well, let's leave the board at what it was at the time, and I can't remember what it was, I think 1,900 maybe. But I told him that figure up a rate, add 2 hours for securing the deck, paperwork, all the necessary things that might be. And he did move the board to about 2,200. And that was, I think, around 1,500. Shortly thereafter, they raised the rate to 100,000. So, you know, catch 22. I came in, he said, well, I just moved the board. And I said, no problem, move it back to 2,100. So the official board as of about 1530 was 2,100.
If anybody had gone ashore that morning, what board would they have seen?
I'd have to look at the log book. I'm not sure what the morning board was. You see, it's a practice, as far as a sailing board, is that a number of times you can get caught. I knew we would not sail probably till 2,000 in that area. But let's say in the middle of the load, the orders had changed, and I had a 2,000 board, and we finished like 1,400 or something really odd. So you move the board progressively as the day goes on. As to what it was set when anybody went ashore, I don't know. I'd have to see the log.
So anybody going ashore during the morning,
right,
would be looking at a 2,100 sailing. Is that correct?
Is that what the log says?
Mr. Johnson, what exhibit are you looking at?
I have a copy of the smooth logbook.
What exhibit number
is 4 Bravo? The sailing board set the previous evening.
It would have been set shortly after the start of the ballast, yes.
Do you recall what that time was?
No.
Was there a crew check made that evening?
Yes, there was.
What time was that check made?
2,000.
Was everybody on board?
No, they weren't.
Who was missing?
It is my understanding that the master, the radio officer, and the chief engineer were not on board the ship. Now, if they were ashore, they could easily call the agent to get updates on the board. That's a common practice in the industry, to call the agent or the dock or the pilots. So the board is not ironclad as you go ashore. You can communicate with the pilots, the agent, or the shore and find out what the current board is. It's the practice aboard the vessel to notify the dock anytime there's a change in the board.
The master had contacted the agent before 3 o'clock. Would he have seen a 2,200 sailing board?
That's possible.
After you left the deck, what did you do next?
Okay, when I left the deck, I had already left the deck. I was in the control room, I believe, in our sequence already. I was in the control room at about 20:30 or so. That's where I was when I stopped talking to you.
And you stated it was condition green, everything was okay on deck. Where did you go from there?
Okay, from there, I stayed in the control room for a little while longer. I think I ran a computer printout, which is the one that I think you all have in your file. I took those ullages off of the SOB gauges. Those are the radar gauges on the ship. And put that in there just to double check that everything was okay, stability, stress, etc. And Everything was fine. So I went to the bridge. Must have been somewhere around 2040, 2045, something like that.
Who was on the bridge at that time?
Yeah, the third mate was on there. He had tested the gear. The pilot was there, and the agent was there.
Did you stop at the master's cabin on the way up?
No, I did not.
Had you seen the captain come back on board?
No, I had not.
So as far as you were concerned, at 2045, the master was not on board?
No, because I asked the third mate, is the master aboard, and he said, yes, he is. Up until that point, arriving at the bridge, I didn't know if he was aboard or not. But as soon as I asked the third mate, he said, yes, the master is aboard.
Was the agent aboard?
The agent was aboard.
And where was the agent?
The agent was on the bridge at that time. She first had come aboard into the control room, and she was looking for times for her log. I informed her that I had already sent the third mate to the bridge to test the gear, and in doing so, he had taken the logbook with him, and that she would have to go up there to get times. So she hung around there for a little while, I think to get the cargo numbers and check on the draft and, you know, some small talk, and then she went to the bridge.
Was she waiting for the master?
I would assume, but I don't know if that was her particular reason for being there. I know she was there to gather up the information that she had to get for her log or whatever it is they have to prepare.
What time did you call all hands that evening?
I'm not sure. I'd have to look at the log, but I assume it was about 20 minutes to 2100, which would be normal. 15 to 20 minutes prior to letting go would be when you would call all hands.
When did you take over the bridge?
It must have been right around quarter till 2045, somewhere in that area.
Did the pilot make any comments as to the status of where the master was?
No, he did not. Not that I can recall.
Were the tugs alongside?
I think they were standing off, but at the time, I really wasn't that concerned. My concern was that it had been snowing during that day, and there had been quite a bit of sleet accumulation, and I was pretty hot and heavy on the crew to get the pilot ladder up, checked out, cleaned off, and re-rigged, and you might say I was kind of riding them on the radio to get it done. And so that's kind of what I was really paying attention to see that that was being done properly.
Did you retest any of the bridge equipment?
Yes, I did.
Can you describe that, please?
I checked that the gyro in the gyro room matched up with the repeater, and it matched up with the steering stand, that the steering was working. I gave it hard right, hard left. I checked the two radars were on, that the CAS system was working. I picked up a target, it picked it up, and then I canceled it. The radios were squawking a little bit, so I didn't really check them. But that was the extent of my check. The third mate had informed me that all gear had been tested and was in good operating order.
And what happened next?
Well, the master came on the bridge, and he asked me, how's it going? I said, everything is going well. He said, how's the load? And I said, the load went well. He said, how's the gear? And I said, the gear is fine. Everything's tested. He said, okay, let's get on with it.
At that time, did you detect alcohol or the scent of beer on the master's breath?
No, I didn't. I didn't get close enough, though, in my opinion, to detect his breath. I never got close enough to him.
What happened next?
The master directed the operation. I was at the throttle, and overheard him, of course, giving instructions to the ABs and to the mates on the deck to tie up the tugs and the positioning of them, letting go of the lines, how he wanted it done. The lines were let go. The helmsman showed up right when we had come single down to our springs, and we let go of the springs and pulled away from the dot. And I would say we were maybe 250 to 300 feet off the dot, and that's when Mr. Cousins came up on the bridge to relieve me.
When you checked the gear, did you check the fathometer alarm?
No, I did not.
Did you check the gyro course recorder, make sure it was?
No, I did not.
If the fathometer alarm was set properly, what would be its normal setting?
There's really no normal setting for the alarm. That would be at the discretion of the master or the pilot. And it would also be where the vessel was. There's many times when a ship transits an area that's only got 2 to 5 feet underneath it, so you wouldn't have an alarm set during that time. In Valdez, I haven't been through Valdez enough to really tell you what would be a normal setting on the Valdez Narrows.
How many trips into Valdez have you made?
By trips, I assume you mean on the bridge on watch.
That's correct.
Okay, so in 1979, I recall being aboard the Exxon Baltimore as a third mate. I don't recall how many trips I made, but maybe, let's say, one round trip. And then I was put in the East Coast trade, and I sailed aboard smaller vessels. The Valdez was my first, quote-unquote, Alaska trader, and it's been the practice aboard this vessel that when they're in the transiting period, to try to get me off my feet, if possible. So I have stood the watch in certain sections, but at the most, maybe one complete round trip on the bridge. That would be from Hitchinbrook to the dock, maybe one round trip.
During your transit to Prince William Sound, is it your perception that your vessel is being monitored by the VTS?
Yes, sir, it was. As to where the cutoff point is, I didn't really have that knowledge, but it was my understanding that there was a point where we would come on radar and that the VTS would actually be monitoring us. I also know that there, you know, while I'm transiting, there's numerous points where I have to give the status of the vessel, its position, its speed, etc., and I'm assuming that somebody is plotting that besides me.
Would you assume that the VTS would be monitoring you in the vicinity of Blyle Island?
Well, I think that's the debate that's going on right now. You know, you're asking me for an assumption. I do not know the answer. I can assume yes.
Mr. Kunkel, you were relieved by the third mate. What did you do next?
I went straight to my room, took a shower, and went to bed. I had been up for most of the time during the load, little cat naps, and I finally was able to say to myself, well, the job's done, I can now go to bed and go into a deep sleep, which is what I tried to do.
And what time was that?
It had to be somewhere around 2200 in that area, and by the time I finished my shower, etc., it must have been 2215, 2220, something like that.
Would you describe the events that occurred when you awoke later that evening and you felt the shuddering of the Valdez?
I was obviously asleep, and the vessel began to shudder. How long it was shuddering before I actually realized it was shuddering, I don't know. I was in a deep sleep. But it did start to shudder enough to bring me out of the sleep. And it's not unusual for a ship to shudder. Of course, they may have just been making a turn or speeding up the engine or operating the throttle. As a chief officer, you kind of learn to sleep lightly on a ship anyway. you're listening for changes in noises. But the noise did intensify, and then, although no one else seems to have heard it, I heard what was like a clanging sound, clank, 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 and that immediately alerted me that something indeed was not right, that it was not normal to hear a sound like that. And so I got up and put my clothes on. I did not look at the clock. I do not know what time it was. I went to the bridge, and as I opened up the door to the chart room, I recall the third mate in the chart room. And I said, was it the turbo? It's my understanding that the sister ship had had trouble with her turbo. We previously had had trouble with the turbo. And I was concerned that maybe it had, you know, blew apart or something. And he said, no, I think we're aground. And to the best of my knowledge, the quote was, the captain knows. I assume that that meant that the captain was aware that my position now would be down. I went down below, and I recall waking up the second mate and letting him know that something was wrong. I believe I used profanity to do it, but anyway, I woke him up. I grabbed my survival suit because I had no idea what the situation was and went down to the cargo office. And just prior to entering the cargo office, I also alerted the pumpman that we may have some trouble. And then I walked into the cargo office, or the control room.
Mr. Cousins stated yesterday that he observed you having a conversation with the master on the bridge. Is that correct at that time?
Well, I did have a conversation with the master on the bridge, but not at that time. I do recall sometime shortly thereafter coming back to the bridge with a printout and showing it to the captain. It's possible that that's what he's talking about, but that was the time that I came up and saw the master.
Is it possible that you made it to the bridge before the master?
That's possible. But
you
I don't
the master
know.
On the bridge.
I did not enter the bridge at that time. I only entered the chart room.
Starting with the events when you arrived at the cargo control room to make your initial damage assessment, would you describe that process, please?
First of all, the summary up here is essentially correct.
What summary are you referring
to? The one that you guys gave me.
An actual interview summary.
Exhibit number on the front of it, please.
Okay, where would that be?
Six Bravo.
Six Bravo.
Oh, okay. This is Exhibit 6 Bravo. Okay. I walked into the cargo control room and looked at the SOB gauges. Those are the radar gauges that I told you about earlier. And to my horror, the tanks had lost quite a bit of cargo. I believe this thing here has said 10 to 15 feet of cargo, when actually the ullages were all reading approximately 25 feet. Okay, so that would mean that some tanks had lost a little bit more than 10 feet, some had lost a little bit less than 10 feet. So they all would average to about a 10-foot loss of cargo in the tanks. With that in mind, the remaining cargo was not 44 feet, it would be about 67 feet. The tanks are mostly around 92 feet deep. So I'm not sure. I remember when we were talking about this that, you know, we were kind of dealing with numbers off our head. And anyway, that's the ullages were approximately 25 feet. And that would translate to about 67-foot inage, not 44 feet. Well, that meant we'd lost quite a bit of cargo. At that time, I didn't know the exact amount. I immediately called the master, and I told him that it looked like we had 8 cargo tanks and 2 ballast tanks damaged, or something was going on in those tanks. There was movement. You're calling it here 10 cargo tanks. It was actually 8 cargo tanks and 2 ballast tanks, but a total of 10 tanks. Right. 1 through 5 center, 1 starboard, 3 starboard, and 5 starboard were all showing movement, flow out. 2 starboard and 4 starboard, which are segregated ballast tanks, were showing movement in. I don't mind telling you that at that moment I knew that my world would never be the same again. I feared for my life at the time. I wondered if I'd see my wife again. I had no idea of how bad this was, but it was the worst thing I'd ever been involved in. I told the master of the situation and asked him if we should ring the general alarm. He told me, no, Jim, the most important thing to do is to stay calm and let's get a good assessment before we fly off the handle. I said, very well. Do you want me on the bridge? He said, no, keep working down there. Take a look at the stresses and the stability. So that's what I did. I started putting in some numbers. I entered that the vessel was aground in the loadmaster. Well, it's called ocean motion. And then I also entered that we were damaged, to the best of my ability, 10 tanks. The printout that came out in the first try indicated that the vessel stresses were exceeding acceptable limits, but that the stability was still acceptable. Now, in your description here, we use the words positive and negative. The proper term would be required stability. The printout shows you what's required versus what you have and makes a ratio. So the ratio must be 1. And here it says 1 foot. Well, it's the ratio is 1. Okay, so the ratio was 1 or greater. In other words, the stability was okay, according to the printout. I took this to the master on the bridge personally because I knew he would probably want to see it, and I'm assuming that that's the occasion that Mr. Cousins is talking about. He looked at it and said, well, we talked a little bit, and I told him, it looks like we're definitely not going to sea. We're definitely not leaving the area. He said, yes, we're definitely not leaving the area. He said, well, so then I said, well, you want me to stay up here and help out? And he said, no, go down there, you know, keep an eye on things, see if anything else lets go, and then if possible, work up some options. Perhaps we may have to ballast some other tanks down. I said, very well. At this time, I've also have the pumpman checking the pump room. So when I get back to the control room, the pumpman tells me that the pump room is in good condition. I believe that somewhere along the lines, the Coast Guard asked if we had the ability to move product. When the question was posed to me, it was, do we have the pump room? And the answer was, yes, we have the pump room. So in other words, we assume that we had the ability to use our pumps. I then put in some more, well, like any other good computer, it dropped the program. So I had to boot it back up again. And after booting it up again, I entered with an intact condition, just for my own curiosity, to see how that would compare to the stability. Well, on this occasion, with the new numbers that I had put in, the stability was now marginal. It was not meeting required stability. And my understanding of required stability is that when a vessel is made, given a definable damage that the vessel can sustain and still remain afloat, and that's what's in my loadmaster for required stability. Although the stability may be positive, the ship may not. In other words, if you have less than that, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to sink, but it means that you do not have required stability. This time the program came up where it showed 1. However, looking at the numbers,
they were like 15.45 was required, and I had 15.43, let's say. So in other words, it still shows one, but we are really marginal. I immediately relayed that to the old man. This would be, I would assume, sometime prior to 0100. And at that time, I made the recommendation to him that we do not leave the area, that the ship, in my opinion, was not stable to move. Now, what Mr. Hazelwood was doing at that time, I'm not sure because he was on the bridge, but I assume he was trying to keep us in the area.
When you reported to the master the first time, about what time was that?
I would say around 12:30, midnight 30, maybe 25 minutes to 1, somewhere in that. Time is really very difficult for me to get a good perception of. I'm walking around wondering, you know, if I'm going to see the sunrise, etc. And we were doing the best we could to try to ascertain what was going on. And I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to the clock. But I would assume it was in the 12:30 to 20 minutes to 1.
And when did you determine the initial loss of cargo, the amount of?
That had to be, I believe the Coast Guard or somebody wanted to know how much cargo we had lost. And I worked up a number at that time, and I don't recall what it was, but I gave it to the bridge. And since I had the tables and everything at my disposal, I went in with about a 25-foot ullage, and I found that if that was the case, we had lost on that the first time I looked at it, somewhere around 115,000 barrels of cargo.
In how much time?
I don't know. From the grounding to the time I looked at it, we lost 115,000 barrels. So based on whenever the grounding was, it could be a half an hour, it could be 20 minutes. I doubt if it was any less than 15 minutes.
When you made your initial report to the master, how far away were you standing away from him?
Maybe as far as I am from here to this gentleman. A little bit closer because I had to hand him the report.
So you're within an arm's length. Did
Yes.
you detect any scent of alcohol or beer on his breath at that time?
At that time, the only scent in the air was petrol vapors from the crude oil. On my way to the bridge, I had to stop twice and wonder if maybe I should have grabbed an MSA. The vapors, of course, had collected in the passage, the stairwell, and it was very, very dense. When I got to the bridge, it cleared up a little bit, but I still had the vapors, so I did not smell alcohol on the captain's breath.
So in your estimation, the fumes were entering the house, the deck of the house, in what manner? Through the ventilation system?
Maybe through the ventilation system. That's a possibility.
Was there any consideration of shutting down the fans?
At that time, no. We did talk about the possibility of fire. We opened up a couple monitors, but it was very shortly thereafter that the vapors just dissipated. It was as if in other words, on my way back down, they didn't seem to be as overwhelming.
Is there a PA system that operates on the bridge?
Yes, there is.
And is there smoking allowed inside the deck house?
Inside the deck house?
Yes.
Yes.
Was any announcement made to extinguish all cigarette smoking or?
No.
Was there any efforts to prepare the lifeboats in case something should occur?
Yes, there was. Later on, I'm not sure when, but yes, there was.
You're not sure how much later?
Yeah, within a half an hour or so. See, what happened was is that the vessel settled shortly after 1, I guess, sometime in that area. She took a starboard list and literally just settled there and didn't move anymore. And I think at that time we realized that we were hard aground.
Yeah. How was the crew notified?
I wasn't aware of it at the time, but apparently the somebody went around and woke him up.
You're listening to James R. Kunkel, the first mate on the Exxon Valdez. This is joint coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearings, a production of KSKA Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network.
No, it didn't. It stayed that way until the tide changed, and then she listed back to port. And the whole time we were on the rocks, which I was there throughout the period, she would go maybe a maximum of 1.5 to 2 degrees to port. And I believe on the one night where there was an exceptionally high spring tide and weather, she made it to about 6.5 degrees to starboard.
Did you have an opportunity to look over the side and see what kind of oil was coming out?
I had an opportunity to look over the side. I've never seen oil in the water in this kind of quantity. But I assume, based on the training I've had, it'd be like putting storm oil in the water, because the wavelets didn't have the appearance of regular water moving around. They were kind of a subdued wavelets. But it was so dark, even with a light on it, you really couldn't tell if there was oil on the surface or not.
So you went from the bridge back down to the cargo control room, is that correct?
When?
After you met with the master?
Yes. Then I also made, all this is going on, and I really would like to say that this is a sequence, and I'm just doing the best I can to give it to you. But somewhere in this time period, I then did a personal check of the pump room, and I also did a round of the deck, and I found everything on deck to be okay, but there was some really strange noises up around 3 center in that area, like metal. But the ship seemed to be staying right where she was at. Sometime during that time, I know the second mate went up and lowered the anchors, did something with the anchors. I think he went up to the bridge shortly after I woke him up and checked it out. He also came down to the control room. And then I guess we're now talking around 2 o'clock or so. I'm still in the control room, wandering around checking the ship. And the engineers were constantly giving me conditions of the voids. In my computer, I have the ability to enter a flooded engine room, a flooded double bottom, whatever. So I had them checking all those, and the chief engineer was in charge of that, and then responding to me what the condition. Thank God they were all dry. Everything looked good. We had one area that really wasn't of concern based on the overall picture, but we definitely had a breach in the double bottom under the starboard void, under the starboard slop tank, which we affectionately call the void. The way we found that out is that the pumpman and third assistant engineer opened up the sounding tube, and we had a geyser a fair distance, 60, 70 feet, I guess.
And you stayed in the cargo control room until when?
Well, I wouldn't really say I stayed in the cargo control room. It became pretty evident to me at that time, after checking with the master, that the ship was stable. She was going to stay there for a while. There wasn't much we could do. Help was on the way. And I had been up since the time that we docked the ship, taking cat naps, of course, but for the load, I was up. I didn't get my good night's sleep, and I knew that as soon as the sun came up and as soon as help was on the way, I would be right in the center of the activity. So I tried to force myself to sit in my chair, and I found that to be very difficult. Somewhere along the way, I made a satellite phone call to my wife and told her that she would be hearing something in the news pretty soon, but that I was okay and not to worry about me. And then anybody I saw, I would say, how are you, how you doing? Everything's okay, don't worry about it, we're gonna be all right, that kind of stuff. And whenever possible, I would sit in my chair and relax.
Did you talk to the master before you retired to your cabin?
On a couple occasions, yes, I did.
Could you describe your conversation, please?
Well, A few times it was, what should we do? Basically what we're doing, we sounding the tanks, checking if any other tanks have been breached, if that type of stuff. And then on a more personal nature, the master mentioned that, this is one way to end a career. It was quite obvious that this was going to be a major, major problem, major disaster. And as a licensed officer, you're always responsible. That's all there is to it. If you've got the license, you're on the box.
Did you detect the scent of alcohol or beer in his breath at this time?
During that time? I never did at this time. No, I sure didn't.
Was the vessel still leaking cargo when you retired your cabin?
She was, I figure that sometime in the 0200 to 0500 area, it slowed down to a leaching type activity. I didn't retire to my cabin ever. I couldn't. There's no way I could sit down for more than 10 or 15 minutes. So I would constantly get up, go back down, take a look around, see if, indeed another tank had opened up, and then I would go back and sit down for a few minutes. But the ship was still leaking, yes.
What time was high water on the 24th?
I did not know that at the time. I believe you all figured it out here. I can read it to you, but I did not know what it was. You say 0206, which makes sense in the fact that we found that at high tides the ship would go to starboard, and that she would go to port when it went to low tide. So as the tide was going down, I'm sure the cargo was leaching out of there. Now the thing is too is that as to the quantity, I had not looked in to starboard yet or for starboard. In other words, I was assuming that water was coming into those tanks. We later found out that they indeed had been breached internally and the bulkheads had split and there was oil in those tanks as well as the forepeak. So the concept of all that oil going in the water at that instant may not have happened. Maybe some of that quantity was actually transferring within the vessel. But of course, I had no way of knowing that at that time. My gauges only give me total in the tank, not an interface.
Do you have any conversations with company officials over the Marsat?
I believe the captain called somebody, I think you said it was Paul Myers, in the early morning hour sometime, and had a discussion with him. I don't recall if I was in there at the time or not, but I'm sure that whatever stability information I had passed on to him, he had passed on to Mr. Myers, and I'm sure there had he must have relayed the current condition of the vessel and the condition of the personnel on board, but I don't, that's an assumption.
Once daylight arrived, what was your assessment of the situation?
Let's see. We weren't going anywhere. That was quite obvious. I believe by that time the Coast Guard had come aboard. I had a real good conversation with a Mr. Falkenstein. He was the only one that came aboard the ship, and the first thing out of his mouth was, "How are you? How are your people? Can we help your people?" Everyone else was, "How much oil did you spill?" Which, of course, is very important. But in a very good fashion, he was interested in the people, and I felt real good that we weren't all alone. I just wanted to interject that because I think it's important. It made me feel good. The master was up and walking around, and I asked him, "Have you ever seen something like this?" And he said, "No, I sure haven't." He said, "I've been aground, but nothing like this." And I told him, "I've never been aground either." And he said, "You were asleep." you know, don't worry about it as far as your license and everything, but, you know, just, we got to just try to make sure that everybody doesn't get hurt, nobody gets hurt, nobody gets injured. And we had secured the deck for C, and by that I mean we had removed a lot of the loose gear, firefighting gear and stuff that would normally be out there while you're in port, but in the Alaskan waters, we found that it's best to remove the stuff that's loose. So we started putting that stuff back out, realizing that we were going to be there for a while. And he also directed me to make sure we put ring buoys out and what have you. And that was some of the activity after daylight.
Did you at any time recommend to the master that the vessel not be boomed?
No, I never did that.
Are you familiar with the discussions surrounding that topic?
No, I'm not. No one ever made me privilege to the booming operation, nor did, to the best of my knowledge, I don't remember anyone asking me about him.
At this late date, can you tell us how much cargo you've calculated was actually lost?
In my opinion, I think the last numbers I looked at before I left the ship, which was the 5th of May, I guess about a week, a little over a week ago, approximately 260,000 barrels.
And could it have been more or less? Could it have been more than 260,000 barrels?
Well, I kind of doubt that, because those numbers are based on the vessels that I lightered to, that I became involved with in the barges, and I took those quantities that independent gaugers said were aboard those ships and subtracted it from the amount that an independent gauger said I loaded. And to the best of my ability, I don't think it could possibly be more than that.
When did you learn that you were going to commence lightering operations to the Baton Rouge?
Well, I was told we were going to do it right away. Immediately, as soon as daylight came or the ship was on its way, a scenario like that. And so we immediately pulled out the Alaska gear that we were required to have, and lo and behold, it was all there and it was in good shape. So my third mate, who would normally be responsible for checking that stuff, had done a darn good job because it was all right in place. We put it together. And then it was realized that in this kind of an operation, we'd want to have a heck of a lot more quantity moving than through a 6-inch hose. So I think the alert went out to get as much hose and reducers and pumps and anything that's available sent to the ship. And while this stuff was in transit, we were just round the clock trying to get things together to do this operation.
When did the Baton Rouge come alongside?
I'm not sure. I think it was within a day or two, but I'm not positive.
Did you have any initial problems pumping cargo, lightering operations initially?
The original plan had been to try to pump out the port side, which we had pretty much determined was still intact. And after doing my stability calculations, I recommended that we do not pump that side out without first consulting a naval architect. So the naval architect did come back with a game plan on how to pump that side out. We figured that would be the quickest way to get cargo out was the intact system that we thought we still had. The ship normally discharges by opening sluice valves and what we call sluice back to 5 center. Well, you couldn't do that because you were obviously open to the sea. So the tanks that had been breached, we would have to pump them with some other method. So we did start cargo up, and we noted what appeared to be more oil in the water. So we shut down with the idea that perhaps the ring main had been damaged. The ring main is a piece of pipe that goes all around the vessel and allows you to take an independent suction out of each tank on the ship. So we shut it down. Not because we knew it was damaged, but because we felt it wasn't worth trying it. Because if that was the cause of more oil, it could have been inert gas pressure, it could have been a change in the tide, could have been a diver down there, or, well, I don't know if the divers were there, but in other words, we weren't sure, but we knew it wasn't worth putting more oil in the water. So we stopped operation and waited for portable pumps.
Do you have any other comments to make regarding the grounding and the events that happened shortly thereafter before I switch to another topic?
No, I sure don't. I think that covers it.
I just have one question regarding the overtime of unlicensed personnel. Okay. Is it true that as chief officer you signed the overtime for the unlicensed deck personnel?
That's correct.
Excluding weekends
mm-hmm.
and penalty time,
okay.
What is the average overtime hours per AB per month?
Normally, they would work about 4 hours a day. Okay. It depends on the AB. I have ABs that don't work any overtime at all. I have ABs that are hungry for money. Them I will not allow to work like on Sunday or something. So you could conceivably have an AB who works, let's say, 4 hours a day, 5 days, let's say 6 days a week. And so that would be 24 hours overtime a week. Multiply that by four, and that'll give you non-operational type overtime. Okay, so then you can take that as maintenance overtime. And operational overtime will vary on the trade and the run where we are. 1 month we may only be in Valdez, so that's one port call. The next pay period we could conceivably be in San Francisco lightering for, let's say, a week or so. And we have lightering ships coming and going, so there would be a lot of operational overtime.
Would the 4 to 8 AB make significantly more overtime than an 8 to 12 or the 12 to 4?
He or she has the ability to do that because conceivably they could work 8 hours every day for overtime.
So that would be how many hours per week and how many hours per month?
Well, 8 hours a day, multiply that by 30 and that's your number.